Hey guys, welcome back to Campaign War Stories. I'm Wesley Donahue. This is the podcast where we talk to folks in the political industry about the insanity that is campaign life. And today I'm joined by the newest vice president of Push Digital Group, Corey Ville. In this episode, we go deep into what we see happening this cycle when it comes to digital. All right, Corey, welcome to the podcast finally.
Hey, it's great to be on, Wes. Thanks, man.
And welcome to Push Digital Group, man. How's it been for the, like, what, about a month now?
Yeah, a little over a month. It's been, honestly, man, it's been great. You guys have built a great culture here. I've enjoyed it. Everybody's been so welcoming, and even got to visit Charleston, South Carolina for my first time ever. So it was nice to get a feel for what you guys are doing down there. Beautiful office. And yeah, man, I can't say enough good things. I really mean it. It's been a great ramp on, and thanks for everything you built here. I mean it. It's really been great.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, first off, I'm sorry I missed you when you came to Charleston. My wife went on a hunting trip and decided to leave me with three little boys by myself for 5 days. And I shouldn't like brag about it, but the most I've ever had them by myself was 3 days. So 5 days was pushing it, and I survived. And even better news is that all three of them survived.
that's what your wife really cared about, is that they survived.
Exactly. Well, I am sorry that I missed you. That was your first time to Charleston ever?
It literally was. Yeah, it's shocking. Of all the places I've been, I've traveled so much, just like you, over the years. But that is literally the first time I've been in Charleston. So it was fun, man. Great to see it. I got to take in some of the good food there, and can't wait to get back.
What did you think of our beautiful historic city?
Oh, amazing, man. I mean, it's so different. I'm out here in Arizona, so it's just such a, you know, we became a state in 1912. And so,
yeah.
So there, you guys got things that are a little older there, and your office and just all the buildings. I took a walk from the hotel my first day to get over to the office, and it was just great to take in the sights. And it's such a different world from out here out west. So it was great, man. I love the architecture. I just love the, it's a great vibe. I can see why you guys love it there. And I have a few friends that have visited Charleston and some that live there now, and they brag about it so much. I think they're part of the tourism bureau. Everybody there.
It's just amazing how big this country is, in that Arizona and Charleston, like, these places seem like different planets, really.
Yeah, no kidding. No, that's so true, man. It is. Arizona, I mean, old here is 50 years, right? If something's 50 years old here in Arizona, it feels old for us. So, yeah, it's a different world, but no, it was great, man. I loved it. And love the office. It's fantastic.
220 years old, the office.
That's what I heard. I heard when you guys were remodeling it, you pulled up some floorboards and found documents and other things.
Yeah, all kind of stuff. Yeah, but This thing is old. We went down to the studs, and as much as the city would let us, the problem with these buildings is the Preservation Society's like crackdown on what you are and are not allowed to do. In fact, they wouldn't even let us have ceiling fans on the porches because they said nobody 220 years ago had ceiling fans. And I was like, They didn't have electricity either, but you're letting me have lights. So bizarre.
That is bizarre.
You and I are close to the same age. We kind of got into this digital thing around the same time. So you and I have known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
Tell your story, like how you got into politics.
Yeah, for sure. My story is, I don't think you've even heard the full range of my story. I'll try not to make it too long, but I came into politics in a very unusual way, I think, than most people. I actually was very interested in attending the U.S. Naval Academy when I was in high school. Okay. And I went to a government teacher, and that government teacher said, well, you need a senator's or a congressional nomination. And I said, well, I have no idea what that means. And she said, I have a good friend. It works for John McCain, who then was obviously a sitting senator. Mm-hmm. This was quite a few years back. And she said, you know, you should go there and you should talk to them about it because, you know, they're friends of mine and they'll at least, you know, point you in the right direction. So little did I know when I walked into that office that day this is going to age all of us, but that was back in 1991. So way back when, I was just a kid, and I walked into the office, and I basically told him what I told my government teacher. I want to go to the U.S. Naval Academy, and I'd like to get your help. And what I didn't realize, which was so touching for me to think back on years later, what I didn't realize is that they really took up my cause, if you will. They got excited about my dream to go to the U.S. Naval Academy. And they kind of helped me run through all the traps of that and figure that out, and helped me to figure out my package, getting it together. I ended up doing community college for a year to kind of help my package to the Naval Academy look a little better. Mm-hmm. And so that was a 2.5 year journey where I thought I was heading to the Naval Academy, but what was really happening is I was falling in love with politics. And so I was in the office every day. I was meeting all the people on his staff. I ended up in D.C. for part of that time. I actually arrived in D.C. In January of 1993 as Bill Clinton was getting inaugurated.
Wow.
Which hopefully some people listening to this will know who Bill Clinton is. It was a long time ago, but this is more for politicos, so they'll understand. Bill Clinton came on the TV, I don't know, two nights ago, and I asked my daughter, who's 18, I said, "Do you know who that is?" And she said, "I don't know who that is."
Oh, wow.
And I felt really old. So anyway, long story long, I went through all of that and got a call one day. Well, first of all, got McCain's principal nomination. And as you might know, John McCain and Jimmy Carter are kind of the two most distinguished alumni from the Naval Academy in terms of being, you know, famous politicians.
Yeah.
And I got McCain's principal nomination, which basically means from John McCain, arguably one of the most distinguished graduates of the Naval Academy, although he would have disagreed with that. His principal nomination really means this is the one guy in Arizona that I want to go to the Naval Academy. So with that as the context, I got a call from the Dean of Admissions at the U.S. Naval Academy. And he started the call by saying, I've never called an applicant ever. I've never done this. We have a process. We go through it. But I'm calling you today because I wanted to let you know, and I've just let Senator McCain know, that we're not letting you into the Naval Academy. And
why?
Yeah, I know.
What is the reasoning? I mean, it's John McCain in the Naval Academy. I mean, you would kind of assume that it's like an automatic entry.
Exactly. That's what I assumed. So, but he was calling me to let me know, and God is my witness, Wes, here's what he said. He said, I could let you into the Naval Academy. I'm sure you'd have a great career in the Navy. He said, but I think God has another plan for you. Really? That's what he said. He said, I think God has another plan for you. And so I know it's going to hurt, but I'm not going to let you in. And I've told Senator McCain, and I wish you the best. If you ever need anything, I'm here for you. But I think you have a different path.
That's bizarre. And that was it. I mean, there was no other reasoning given. And
there wasn't. There was.
You didn't find out from Senator McCain's office. I mean, there has to be something else there, right?
I wish I could. This is many years later. That was what I lived with. That's all he said, and that's all the context I got.
Wow, that would be bothering me like 30 years later, man.
You know, I think on the surface, I would 100% agree with that. I think what it did is it set me on a path to really find my passion and what I wanted to do. And you know what I love about that story is it's always a good reminder for me that God was looking out for me. God had my path. Thought out long before I did. And I ended up falling in love with politics. That's the bottom line. I realized that those 2.5 years, while I thought I had my eyes on the Naval Academy, I really was learning a craft and seeing Senator McCain very up close at a very young age and seeing what it meant to be a politician and a statesman. And yeah, I fell in love with everything about politics. And that was the beginning of a long career. So it was an unusual way to get started, but it's part of my story. And I, you know, 30 years later, hindsight's always 20/20. 30 years later, I'm very thankful that it happened that way.
How did the campaign side of the career start?
Yeah, so it really was there. I mean, I was on Senator McCain's first reelect when he was a U.S. senator in 1982, and went to D.C. And then I kind of went through. My career was a little unusual. Again, I would be in a political campaign, and then I'd bounce into a technology company. There was a few startup technology companies here in Arizona, and I had a few friends that were running those, and so. That's really where I got kind of the, you know, long before, as you well know, long before digital and politics kind of intersected, I was bouncing between the two careers. I really enjoyed technology and digital, and I really enjoyed politics. And so bounced between those two careers for a while before it became something that that people actually wanted to pay for on a campaign.
What was the first digital focused job that you had? In politics, I mean, obviously you're working with technology. Where did those two officially converge for you?
You know, the convergence was in January of 2009, so 14 years ago. That was the real convergence. Senator McCain had just lost the presidency to Barack Obama. Had come back to Arizona, is running for re-election for the 2009-2010 cycle. And I actually got a call from him. Which I was, you know, it was always, you know, I obviously knew him, but you know how it is when, you know, I didn't know he had my number. So I actually got a call from him, and he said, "I want you in the office in 2 hours." And I hadn't worked for him for 4 or 5 years. And so I don't know if he thought I still worked for him or not. He said, "I want you in the office in 2 hours." And so I had to call a few people to go, "I don't know what office he's talking about." And so anyway, I figured it out. I got in there, and he basically was coming back to Arizona after being a national figure for so many years. You know, he was obviously still the Arizona senator, but he ran in 2000. He ran in 2008 for president, and he was coming back to Arizona, and there was a lot of questions about could he reestablish himself as an Arizona senator after being a national figure for so long. And so it was a race that a lot of people were looking at a little bit with some trepidation of could Senator McCain win re-election in the environment that had developed both for him and just nationally as well.
Yeah. And then you went and worked for the re-elect campaign as what? The digital director?
I did. I was the digital director. And that was the title back in the day. I guess we still use it nowadays, but I guess E director was one for a while.
Yeah.
You remember way back when?
Yeah. I think like Brian Athey was telling me he was like E director at the RNC. I was like, E director. Nice.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
When he called you and said, "Get my office in 2 hours," did he realize that part of his loss was because of digital and that he needed to ramp up digital? That he just, what was going on there? Because,
yeah,
actually,
no,
and to bring it full circle here, now that you're at PDG, and we had obviously just acquired Campaign Solutions. Becky Donatelli and the Campaign Solutions team was a major part of his digital effort. Now, they did a great job, but it was no Barack Obama. Like, Barack Obama's campaign literally changed the entire landscape and taught us things that we didn't even know we were supposed to know. Yeah. So did he just, you know, lose and then come home and say, "All right, I need a digital expert"?
You know, it's a great question. That's exactly what happened. That meeting started with him saying, you know, and again, I've known the Campaign Solutions team for 20 years. They're great folks. They do an amazing job. But, you know, I would argue that the Obama campaign, did an amazing job on digital, but they also caught lightning in a bottle a little bit. Right. They had a candidate that fit the new digital mode, I think, in a way that no one had ever come along since then, before that. So, he did. He sat down and he said, "Listen, I feel like we got our butts kicked in digital, and I don't want that to happen again, and I'd like you to fix it." And then he walked out of the room. So I wasn't sure if I had a job or what, but over the next couple of weeks, it turned into me leaving my job and moving into his campaign.
Any idea how that came together? Did he just know you were working in technology companies, or did someone come to him and say, hey, we got this guy, Corey, that's been part of the McCain family for years, and he's also doing this tech stuff? Like, any idea how that phone call happened?
No, that's good. It was the latter. Yeah, I think it was the latter. He was like, we got to fix this issue, we call. And the inside the campaign, the response was, Corey can do this for us, and let's bring him in and talk to him. And so that's how it came about. It was a kind of a mutual effort. A lot of good friends that I still have from the McCain days, including folks on the campaign solutions team, that were in my corner and wanted to see if I could help.
Oh, that's awesome, man! What happened after McCain World? What came?
A ton of stops. I'll kind of do the flyover here. After McCain, it was for me, not all of us get an opportunity to work on a presidential kind of on the ground in the state. But this was my shot at doing that in 2011, 2012. I was the digital director for Tim Pawlenty and moved the whole family to Minneapolis, left Arizona, rented our house, and moved to Minneapolis with a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old then, so often is the case. And I actually was in Minneapolis from April to October, which is like the most amazing time to be in Minneapolis. A month later, there was like 10 feet of snow and just insanity there. So I was glad I got out when I did. I wasn't glad the campaign ended, but weather-wise, it was good. It was good to leave.
That ended way quicker than a lot of people thought it would.
It did. I was just reminiscing with a few folks. In fact, on that campaign, Elise Stefanik was, I shared a cube with her on that campaign.
Did she did. Really?
She was in Minneapolis on that campaign. Alex Conant, who I know you know well, he was the comms guy for that. And so, yeah, it was a lot of fun people. In fact, in Iowa, I shared a cube with Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Did you really?
She was in Iowa helping us out. So yeah, it's funny how years later the things happen. So yeah, that was Pawlenty. And then when that ended, I actually went up to DC and was Newt's digital director. I had a good friend that was running his campaign for president. So I kind of went from one presidential campaign to the other. And actually a little footnote that you may not even know, which is right about the time I got to DC and started helping Newt with his digital, FP1 had started. And I was FP1's first digital director.
Really?
I was, yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, they were only, they'd only been, Terry and John and Danny had only been, I think they'd been up for business maybe 6 months. Right. They had literally just started.
Maybe you should have stayed there. Because they just, obviously, I mean, insider stuff, but they just sold to Omnicom and, I have heard wild numbers, like what they've sold out for. But I mean, everything between like $100 million to $350 million. Who knows what they actually sold for? But it's, you know, obviously public information that they sold. But maybe you stay, you can walk away with a few million dollars.
Well, who knows? Who knows what would have happened? It was funny because most people don't know that I was a part of FP1 so many years ago.
I had no idea.
It was so early in their process, and they were just getting started, and. Anyway, they're a great group of guys. They've done really well. And, so I went from there, actually came back to Arizona after that and was a part of Bass Digital. They're based out of San Diego, Adam Stoll, Amanda Bloom, great group of people.
Yep. They did great work.
I was based here in Arizona. They're now mostly, in the public affairs side of things.
They're smart.
They
went the smart route. Yeah, they went the smart route. They're doing all those massive California ballot initiatives.
That's right, and clients that pay their bills, right?
Exactly.
They're great. And so I was there for a good, I was there for 6 years, loved it. Helped them grow from a smaller firm to a much larger firm, and really enjoyed that process. Met some great people along the way and worked on some really fun campaigns. And then the last 6 years was with Lincoln Strategy Group, based here in Arizona. Great, great firm. They do great work as well. Some political, some public affairs, some corporate education. They're kind of all over the all over the map in terms of their client base. And and then a whole month and a couple of days here at PDG, man.
So you were at Basque for 6 years, Lincoln for 6 years. Is that right?
Yeah.
So we get you for, we still got you for another 5 months and or 5 years and 11 months. So
that's right. If you'll have me, man, I don't, in our business, I totally get it. Things change from cycle to cycle. I've always been a guy that liked to stick with the team for a good amount of time. I think it's the best way to go.
I love it, man. All right, but before you tell your one of your favorite campaign war stories, I got really three questions for you, all digital. Yeah. First is, and this is a big one, what are the major change? Like, you and I kind of got into digital around the same time.
Here yeah, we did.
15, I think I started what was then Donahue Direct, now Push Digital Group, 15 years ago. You said four, so around the same time.
Yeah,
and we've exactly. known each other. You know, you and I have ran into each other many, many, many times in those 15 years. But what are the the big changes that you've seen from then until now?
Yeah, so many, right?
That's like a big one. Yeah.
It's a huge one. I would say, just looking back on it, I mean, first of all, when I really first started into digital, I mean, and I'm sure Becky has told you her stories too, over at Campaign Solutions. I mean, there wasn't social media, right? It really didn't exist. Even in 2009, 2010, the McCain's race, it was, certainly it existed, right? But it was really not anywhere near a level of where everybody was checking their phones constantly all day. And in fact, just a funny story for you. Senator McCain used to always walk into my office and ask me how the Facebook was doing. And he knew exactly what he was saying. He wasn't just making a mistake. He knew he was bothering me by saying it.
Love it.
And I told him, I said, one day you're going to say that on the air. You're going to say it. And sure enough, about 6 months after that, he accidentally said it on television. And he got out of the interview and he looked at me and he kind of winked and he goes, yeah, you were right. And, so much has changed. I mean, we went from being a kind of a website centric, mm-hmm. digital operation, right? Where a website was everything to, in some ways, I mean, a website still matters. It still needs to be a page where that exists, but it's been so diminished in terms of its eyeballs over the years. And I think that, I think the biggest change that I've seen is that there's such a diversity of platforms now. And I know you agree with this. I've heard you talk about it. It makes digital quite a bit more complicated now. I think digital used to be a lot simpler, candidly, in the sense of you used to have very, very few platforms. I think with so many platforms, there's so many audiences and so many things. It's an opportunity for digital, I think, because digital is so good at adjusting content and catering to certain platforms, but it requires a lot of work.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more detail that has to go into digital. And I think it used to be a few simple things that you would do. And now I think those range of tactics have gotten so long and big.
Well, that's kind of where I was getting at. And I was hoping you would lead that I was trying to lead you there with that question is, because you said I was the digital director. And at that point we were in our own little box and our own little cubicle, but now digital means everything. Like every single department is very digital focused.
Yeah.
So you can't just have a siloed digital department these days. Digital is daily comms. Literally, your comms director is basically a digital director at this point because mostly on Twitter. In a U.S. Senate race, 70 to 80% of the dollars we see coming in are digital, low dollar. All the grassroots activities at this point are in some way digitally connected. So, and I'm often asked now, and then obviously with TV, the convergence of TV and digital. So I often, ask when I step into a pitch, like, what is digital?
Yeah.
And at this point, we're just defining digital as, everything delivered over an internet connected device. And that means text is text message. Text is digital. Yeah. A website is digital. Emails are digital. CTV, OTT is digital. And if you ask me, 5 years from now, all of TV is going to be digital.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
And you and I were seeing these things 15 years ago, and people were fighting us. Oh, digital's a fad. Digital's never going to be a thing. Digital's not cost effective. Now we see literally the entire campaign is digital.
That's right. And, you know, I the way I used to always explain it to people is, I mean, bottom line is we want to win. Like, that's right. That's I think, why a lot of us who are in politics love politics. It's kind of like the NCAA tournament, right? There's a winner and a loser at the end.
Yep.
And you fight as hard as you can, and some you lose and some you win. But that fight to the finish is something that I think everybody in our business that stays in it for a career has something inside of them that loves that sort of measurement at the end of a day where, okay, there's a winner and loser. And if we lost, what'd we learn? And let's move on to the next one. And there's an athletic competition in it from my perspective, and the people that I've met that I respect, I think tend to see it that way. And I think that digital is communication, but I the way I used to always communicate to people and still do in many ways is we need to find where the eyeballs are.
That's it.
Like, if the eyeballs were on TV, then I would say, let's go 100% television, but they're not.
That's right. As the digital guy, I've many times step into a meeting and say, actually, you're going to get your biggest bang for your buck on television. In this case, all the time. That's very seldom that's the case, but I can remember a race we did in West Virginia a few years ago when it was literally cheaper just to pound the entire state because the television markets, except for that like DC corner, but the entire state, the media market, they were just so cheap in those DMAs. I was like, actually, your CPMs are higher than your television, 1,000 points on television.
No, that's exactly right. And I think, I feel like that's always an authentic moment with a campaign. It's not about whether it's not that digital works because it's where the eyeballs are.
Sure.
That's why it works. And that's so right. If the eyeballs weren't there, then that wouldn't be the recommendation, but that's where they are. Now, to your point, in some races, it varies. Like in Arizona, it's funny. I was just about to say this and then I'm catching myself because, it's changing so quickly. In other words, my mom is 75 years old and is on Facebook more than I am, right? She's on Instagram more than I am. And so it used to be in Arizona that was kind of the tactic is, well, we're dealing with a lot of, senior citizens, and especially in a primary, they're more TV focused. But to your point earlier, the definition of TV is at best blurred. and at most, TV is digital. I know my TV friends I know it's a challenging transition for them, just like it's been a challenging transition for us over the last 10 years, but there is a transition, and the transition is television does not mean what television used to mean.
That's exactly right. Well, they can't.
Well,
they can't go in and charge, $25,000, $30,000 for an ad shoot anymore and just broadcast that 1,000 points statewide and bang money. Like,
that's right.
The cost of production has gone down. Half your eyeballs are cord cutters, and you got to hit them on digital. Their TV firms are not set up for the future of marketing in general, I believe.
No, they're not. And I mean, I think if you look at, just look at every corporate marketing budget in America, they've changed, right? They still have a television piece. There's no doubt. You'll still see, television, but even quote unquote television ads is really digital delivery. I mean, I'm watching a television ad, quote unquote, on YouTube TV, right? Online, right? So that's why I say I really think TV is digital. I don't think TV exists in the way we have always traditionally described it.
But the difference in that television ad on YouTube TV and on television is that when it's on television, they're talking to an entire DMA. When it's on YouTube TV, they are talking to you. They're using data to talk to you. And if they're talking to you, that means they're talking to your wife differently. And that means you got to have double, triple, quadruple the amount of content. And that's where TV firms are going to fail because they're not used to pumping out that much content that's being forced by the use of data. That's where we're set up to rock it.
This is, I couldn't agree more. This is just like, I love the sports analogies in our business. This is just like an athletic contest. If you told an NFL team you're not allowed to run the ball, they would say, well, you don't win that way, right? In other words, we have to run the ball. There are a new set of tactics and a new set of tools and a new set of data that we overlay over our communication tools now that are different than they used to be. And if we don't use them, we lose.
That's
just
right.
Like if an NFL team doesn't run the ball, they're going to lose.
That's right.
That is something that the NFL has changed over the years too. They do a lot. They play a lot different today than they used to play. The equipment has changed. The plays have changed. The strategies have changed. And it's just like our business, the tactics, the strategies, and the approach has changed. And I love going into conversations with clients and just, we get to be agnostic and say, we just want to win.
That's
so
right.
Where are the eyeballs? We're going to tell you where they are. And we're going to tell you how to reach those eyeballs. And if it's digital, great. If it's television, great. If it's a guy screaming on the street corner, great. Like that's probably not going to be your most effective thing, but, in other words, at the end of the day, we don't get measured by digital budgets. We get measured by wins and losses in our business, which I've always loved. And I really, I just believe our job as digital strategists, which is, it's funny, about, I don't know, maybe like 8 years ago, I started realizing that 80% of my calls were strategic conversations, not digital tactics.
Mm-hmm.
They become digital tactics eventually, but they're really a strategic conversation about how to reach voters and what's the right message and how to do it. And that's, I think sometimes that gets missed, that digital is kind of, you know, ones and zeros, which it is. There's no doubt there's a tactical side to digital, but the strategic side is so important these days, especially with a data layer on top of everything that's so sophisticated now. You really can run a digital ad campaign that, like you said, reaches you with one message and your wife with another, and does it effectively. And we all have, you know, how many times do we lift our phones every day? I don't know what the last time I checked, the number was like 70 or something, you know, and if you go down an age group, it goes up to like 150.
Yep.
And so, you know, that is how people get their information. There's no doubt that is how people get it. So anyway.
So in all this time you've been doing this, do you have a favorite campaign story?
I have, you won't surprise you, it's with John McCain. He worked on and off for Senator McCain for, 20 plus years. So many wonderful moments with him, so many amazing phone calls I got to overhear in the car with him, with heads of state and presidents, and just the kind of moments that you hope your career has. I experienced that the most with him, and certainly in varying degrees with other people as well. Loved my time with the Pawlenty campaign. Just such a wonderful person. Wish he would have gone farther, but I think politicos realize this, but John McCain was one of the most colorful people on the planet, and so. Out of that came some very funny stories, and I here's my campaign story for you. It's kind of two sides of the same coin, if you want to think of it that way. It was the same event, two stories, two very different outcomes. So here's the first story. I'll make it quick. The first story is John McCain's strategy in 2010 was to do so many town halls that people got sick of him. That was his strategy. And he did it in the presidential race too. That was what he was good at. That was where he thrived. He loved it. So we did three or four town halls a day for over a year. I mean, it was insane how many town halls we did. The numbers up into the 400 or 500. It's crazy how many town halls we did, with some with a couple hundred people, some with a couple thousand. So we were doing this one town hall, and, you know, not everybody knows this, but Senator McCain obviously was at that point had run for president twice. This is 2010. He's famous, right? He's very recognizable, but he never operated with any security apparatus. It was literally just Senator McCain and his staff. which, you know, on any given day was three or four people. And so we were in a town hall, and it was getting pretty contentious. There was some screaming and people, you know, getting very upset and getting a little bit uncomfortable in the room. And so the town hall ended, and as Senator McCain was starting to walk out, myself and another staffer that was with him noticed a pretty big guy sort of coming at him very, very quickly. In kind of, you know, in those moments, you kind of go, that doesn't look right. Like yeah. something's wrong with that picture. And in a room of 1,000 people where Senator McCain had just finished, you know, 2 hours of Q&A, he had the presence of mind not only to see the gentleman coming at him, but also see our reaction. And we started to move toward him at a pace that was quick as well. We were coming to basically knock the guy over. I mean, that's where it was heading. And so I hoped it wouldn't come to that, but we were moving with that kind of speed.
Yeah.
And John McCain lifted up his finger and looked at me and basically said, he mouthed, "Stop." And stopped me in my tracks. And the guy ran to him and stopped right in front of him and just screamed in his face, yelled, it was a really intense moment. And so we stood next to him and he got it all out of his system. And Senator McCain said, "Okay, you good? You got it out?" And the guy said, "Yeah." He goes, "Now let's have a real conversation." And they talked for another 20 minutes. And, you know, I don't know if the guy left agreeing or disagreeing, but he certainly left knowing that John McCain respected him.
That's awesome.
And I love the story because, one, his presence of mind to see everything happening in that second and realizing we were about to escalate a situation and he was trying to de-escalate the situation.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, I love that story. It shows his character. It shows how he, in the midst of a lot of pressure and intensity, he was calm in the storm. Awesome. And I love that about him. So the second story happened the same event as we left. And this is the story that for me is, I've told this for many years. It's one of my favorites. We get in the car. It's four of us. There's a gentleman named Matt who's driving. He's about 20 years old. Myself and Senator McCain's comms person is in the back seat. He's in the front passenger seat. We are driving out of the parking lot. And as we're driving, a code pink protester jumps in front of our car. Ooh. And for those of you that are listening that don't know, you probably all do, the people that listen to this podcast, but Code Pink is an anti-war group that stands up in Congress and unfurls, you know, pink banners and basically is disruptive, right? That's the kindest way to say it. And so so she literally jumps in front of our car and Matt slams on the brakes and she's on the front of our car, just banging on the hood, screaming, yelling, just vile stuff coming out of her. And she was just mad. And so we're stuck. We're in a line where we can't move around her. Like, and so John McCain leans over to Matt, who's driving, and says, "Drive."
Nice.
And Matt goes, "Senator, she's in front of the car." And he goes, "That's okay, just drive." And
oh, wow.
And Matt sort of, you know how you would do, you kind of let off the brake a little bit, you kind of, you know, yeah, move the car a few inches. And she's not moving. She's slamming on the hood still. She is at full tilt. And so Senator McCain leans over again. He says, "Drive." And Matt goes, "Senator, she's in front of the car." And so after maybe about, you know, it felt longer, but it's probably about 60 seconds. Senator McCain yells at the top of his lungs. He goes, "Damn it, drive." Matt slams on the gas. She jumps out of the way and we drive out of the parking lot. But that's not the best part of the story, Wes. The best part of the story is about 30 seconds later, all of us in the car are really quiet. And I hear under his breath, John McCain in the front seat go, "Huh, I knew she'd jump out of the way." That's my favorite John McCain story.
Oh, dude, that guy was an animal, man. That guy was so awesome.
He was. He was great. So yeah, lots of fun stories on the campaign trail.
I was yesterday. I was just wasting time. I was got done with a long run. I was exhausted, sitting on the couch, and I was thumbing through Insta shorts or stories. Sorry, no, it was YouTube shorts. It was YouTube, and that old town hall video of John McCain popped up. Where that woman questioned Barack Obama's ethnicity, or said he wasn't from right. whatever, and he looks up and says, no ma'am, that's not true, no ma'am. Yeah. He's an American, he's a good guy. I was like, can you imagine a politician saying that today?
You can't imagine that. And it wouldn't happen. I think, you know, I think that's an authenticity that I think people still crave. And it looks different for every politician. Authenticity looked different for John McCain than it looks for someone else. It has to be true to kind of who they are. But I think in our world of YouTube shorts and video, I know our firm did Ramaswamy, and I think, you know, not to micromanage that campaign, but I do appreciate the authenticity that of just putting yourself on video and sharing what's going on. I think that serves political candidates really well when they do that.
Yeah, well, and with Vivek, it was great because of those moments we caught that weren't planned. Like, a very similar situation to, you know, your first story. It was like he'd be at a town hall or something. Someone would start yelling at him, and he'd go, "No, come up here and take the microphone. Tell me why you're yelling at me. Let's talk about it."
Yeah, I think that is one of the reasons. He is also incredibly smart, right? Obviously, that comes through too. But so I think you have to have more than just authenticity. But I think you can be the smartest guy in the room, but if you don't have authenticity, I think that doesn't resonate with people, especially in a social media world. It's called social media for a reason.
That's right. I mean, look, and as officially the Vivek Ramaswamy for president digital advisor strat, whatever I was,
right?
That wasn't me. That wasn't Push Digital Group. That was just him. That was just him being him and us catching it on camera. None of that was planned. That's just his situational awareness.
Yeah.
No, very similar to what you're saying about John McCain.
It was, if you know, John McCain caught the tail end of kind of this video revolution that we're in now. And, you know, he would have done very well in it. He would have drove his comms people and his staff crazy, but he would have done very well.
Did you hear the episode with Tim Cameron? We talked about bomb Iran.
I did. Actually listened to that. Yeah, no, that's a perfect example. I mean, he was there was, you know, a sense of humor and an authenticity that, again, now I think we have the tools where that comes through really well for political candidates. And if they don't use it, it's definitely leaving some room on the table.
That's exactly right. Well, brother, we are excited that you have joined the Push Digital Group team. And here's to the next 6 years of working together.
Yeah, same here, man. Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity, and it's been great, and look forward to many years to come.
Thank you for listening to Campaign War Stories. Please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get new episodes sent straight to your inbox by subscribing at WesleyDonahue.com. I hope you have a phenomenal day full of positive vibes.